This is the first week in review for 2016. Happy New Year to you. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have with us two guests from different perspectives to discuss and debate the top news stories in the news this week. And we welcome your input. We welcome the issues in the news this week that you would like to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I know one of the issues we will discuss is the documentary series Making a Murderer. Was Stephen Avery from Manitowoc framed for murder? Should he get a new trial? We'll ask both of our guests who are legal eagles about this story and many others in our Week in Review. Let me welcome our guests. Rick Essenberg is president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a blogger at sharkandshepherd.blogspot.com. Good morning and Happy New Year.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Peg Lautenschlager is also with us. She is a former Attorney General of the state of Wisconsin, former District Attorney, former Democratic State Legislator, and former United States Attorney. Good morning, Peg, and Happy New Year to you.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Rick, and Happy New Year to you both.
Let me also thank Peg, you for coming on very short notice. We learned this week that Eugene Cain, who was scheduled to be with us during this week in review, Eugene Cain's family in Philadelphia posted on his Facebook page that he fell ill on Christmas night and is, as far as I know, still in intensive care at a Philadelphia hospital. They asked for prayers and healing thoughts for Eugene Cain. We don't have any more details, but we certainly do send along those prayers and healing thoughts. But I also mentioned this, Peg, because we did ask you to come on very short notice, and we thank you for doing that.
I appreciate the opportunity, Joy, and I know I did see a post late last night on Facebook from one of his family members indicating that he had opened his eyes, which I think both speaks to some encouraging news and yet speaks to the severity of what he's facing.
Right, exactly. That is hopeful, but yes, he is still in critical condition in intensive care in Philadelphia. And we do send our hopes and prayers for his recovery. Let's talk about another story that, not Stephen Avery and Making a Murderer, but it's in NPR News this morning that President Obama is going to meet with his attorney general on Monday to finalize a set of executive actions on guns that he will unveil next week. So it looks like President Obama, via executive action, is going to impose new gun control curbs. White House officials are declining to comment specifically, but we have heard that that President Obama says Congress has failed to address the growing problem of gun violence, and I know that he has been saying that he wants to do something to expand background checks, among other things, and maybe that's what he wants to do via executive action. Your reaction, Peg, to this news?
Well, I find it interesting. I mean, clearly, it's yet another example of the fact that President Obama is not going to go quietly in his last year in office as a so-called lame duck. I think that there are two issues that are out there. One is the frustration over the stranglehold gun manufacturers have on elected officials in both parties nationwide. While we have recognized for decades, if not centuries, limitations on various rights within the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Guns are one that have become sacrosanct over the years, and I think that the frustration of the national dialogue, which on one side is driven by gun manufacturers saying you can't mess with the Second Amendment, therefore, everything is off the table. is starting to interfere with the number of shootings that we're seeing each year. So I think that that'll be interesting. I also think it'll be interesting, and I'd be curious on Rick's take on this, in terms of the extensive litigation that's going on right now involving executive orders as well as administrative regulations when it comes to conservative state attorneys general and others who can get standing in federal court regarding some of the things which have already been promulgated. Notably, I know there's something with Texas and the immigration executive orders. There's been stuff involving administrative regulations and clean coal and some of the EPA things. So I presume that once Obama decides to do something by executive order, it's going to set off a significant litigation yet again in federal court.
Yeah, before we get Rick to respond to that, a couple more details. According to gun industry insiders and others familiar with the proposals, the changes include requiring an expanded number of small-scale gun sellers to be licensed and therefore to conduct background checks when selling a weapon. This wouldn't close the so-called gun show loophole, though it has the potential to narrow it. The administration is also expected to impose tighter rules for reporting guns that get lost or stolen on the way to a buyer. So any problems with those executive actions, Rick?
Well, I think Peg's second point, I think, is my first concern about something like this. There has been a history within this administration of the president taking an extraordinarily broad view of his ability to sort of go it alone. You remember he said, I have a pen and I have a phone. And so, from areas like immigration, certain forms of carbon emissions and now guns, the president has really tested the limits of executive authority, and I think it's something that we ought to be concerned about, because the fact that you like what he's doing, right? You like what he's doing on climate change, or you like what he's doing on immigration, or you like what he's doing on guns, that should not override concern about the way that it happens, because Barack Obama, if you like him, isn't always going to be the president. We could have, President Rubio or President Cruz. And if President Obama can act unilaterally, so can they. Now, having said that, I can't really comment on whether or not what he's doing here would be an abuse of executive authority. I think some of the things that he's done, many of the things that he has done clearly have been. But, if what he's going to do is adopt some reasonable interpretation of who's engaged in the business of selling guns for purposes of determining who has to do a background check, that may well be within his executive authority. And I wouldn't have a great deal of trouble with it, although it doesn't sound like, although the mass shootings are sort of the inflection point that causes him to want to propose these things, it doesn't sound like any of the things that he's going to propose would have had much to do with any of the incidents that we've seen recently.
It sounds like you reacted to the possible President Rubio or President Cruz doing this, Peg.
Well, I find it interesting because I think there might also be a possible Trump doing it. Executive authority has been used by presidents throughout the ages. There's an argument that Barack Obama has taken it to an extreme. I don't know that I necessarily agree with it. Clearly, at this point in our juncture in our history, we have very conservative courts that have limited his executive authority in many ways. So I think that check and balance is clearly there, and it's kind of antithetical, or it's the exact opposite of what we see in a state like Wisconsin, where a single party or political philosophy governs pretty much all three branches of government now. That being said, I think that it's fair to say that when it comes to the gun loopholes, they may not address some of the mass shootings. The pro-gun side tends to to remark that, you know, this shooting would not have been stopped if there had been X legislation. But I think what we need to do is step back and look at all of the shootings, the incredible number we have in the United States that is disproportionate to any other nation in the world, and determine whether or not any sort of executive order or legislation or whatever it happens to be, some restriction, perhaps you might want to call it, on the right to purchase firearms, will overall make a difference in terms of the gun culture that exists here and the shootings that take place. So, I don't disagree with Rick. Perhaps this expansion of who's a large firearms dealer and subject to the background requirements in selling guns may not have stopped a particular mass shooting or even many mass shootings, but I think we need to look at the broader impact of what that might do in terms of not just those mass shootings which garner national attention, but the day in and day out shootings which are taking place in terms of, you know, the person who goes off half-cocked and ends up shooting a spouse in a domestic situation or whatever else might be occurring out there, which those numbers, too, are frighteningly large.
President Obama said in his weekly radio address, which was released today, that he was moving unilaterally on these changes because Congress had failed to address the growing problem of gun violence. Rick, do you see this Congress or being able to reach agreement on any, gun violence prevention controls?
Oh, they might, but I mean, this is the problem, I think, with President Obama. He says that I'm going to act because Congress hasn't. That is not a proper understanding of his executive authority. When Congress has failed to act in an area in which, you know, Congress is within Congress's scope of authority, that's an answer every bit as much valid as the answer we get when Congress does act. The president does not have the authority to go it alone, and I disagree with Peg that courts have carefully cabined the authority of the president or administrative agencies. I think, in fact, that they have failed to do so, and it's often been conservative judges, who are concerned about being accused of judicial activism, who have been some of the worst on these things. And I think it's past time, and it's difficult because it's technical and it's legal and it's abstract, but I think it's time for us to have a serious conversation about, you know, structural limits on the authority of the president and administrative agencies and the proper role between the states and the federal government. And I know it's boring, and I know sometimes we tend to gloss over those things because we either like what's being done or we don't like what's being done substantively, but I think that these questions are important. I don't know, as I said before, whether this presents the issue because he may be within the scope of his authority. We haven't seen what he's doing yet, but I think it's a very critical issue.
Peg.
Well, if I might add, though, Rick, I think that his saying, "I am acting because Congress has refused to act," opens him up to arguments like yours. But I think what he's trying to say, and perhaps does it in a way that has politicized the debate between Congress and the executive, is that he believes he has the authority to act, but in an ideal world, he would like Congress to act so that all three, at least those two branches of government responsible for the promulgation of laws, are acting in unison. And I think he believes he does have the authority to act, as you mentioned he may in this case, but he's doing so out of frustration that Congress will not act with him. And I think that if you look at that interpretation of what he's saying, he is hoping to act with Congress as opposed to doing it unilaterally within his authority. And I think that's how he views the situation, not that he's trying to say to Congress, you know, you useless no-loads, you're not doing anything about this, so I guess I'll have to. And I think that's a very different spin on the relative authority and workings of the three branches of government.
When we come back, we will talk about other top issues in the news this week, including this new documentary series about Manitowoc County's Stephen Avery and his conviction for the 2003 murder of Teresa Halbach, which has captured the attention of many, ignited viewers nationwide over the past couple of weeks, and some are hoping that this particular documentary series will mean a new trial for Avery. What do you think? Well, what questions do you have? What other issues in the news this week would you like to discuss? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with Peg Lautenschlager and Rick Essenberg during this New Year's edition of The Week in Review here on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the week's top news stories with Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and Peg Lautenschlager, a former Wisconsin Attorney General, former District Attorney, Democratic State Legislator, and former U.S. Attorney. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you would like to join in to talk about the issues making news this week. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We just talked about President Obama planning to take executive action to impose new gun control curbs next week. What do you think about that? You can tell us what you think about that. You can also tell us what you think about this this new documentary series that Netflix is presenting and that a lot of people are binging on over the last 2 weeks. The Netflix documentary series Making a Murderer has drawn worldwide attention to Wisconsin's Stephen Avery. Avery was convicted in 2007 for the murder of Teresa Halbach after famously being exonerated for a rape conviction that he had served 18 years for, a rape he did not commit. The new series is leading many to question how the murder trial was conducted and even Avery's guilt. Peg Lautenschlager, as a former DA and the Attorney General who was in office when Avery was initially exonerated for the rape conviction, what are your general thoughts of this series and the questions being raised?
Questions being raised are perhaps fair. However, I think that the documentary is done in a very pretty much one-sided manner. I don't think there were a few people who were attempted to be contacted for on the so-called prosecution side regarding these things, who opted not to speak. However, I think that the snippets which were used from public record of many of us, and I include myself in there, were selectively picked. The reality is that Stephen Avery was considered a possible perpetrator in 1985 for a sexual assault for which he was wrongly convicted and for which he served 18 years. That wrongful conviction resulted based on two separate photo IDs by the victim of Stephen Avery. Now, the processes used in those photo IDs in 1985 were very much standard practice for police agencies throughout America. However, by 2003, when he was exonerated, those ID procedures were considered to be untrustworthy and indeed were procedures that had been changed. And indeed, we changed them around that time in Wisconsin. It was just stuff that was coming to the fore at the time. The second thing about it is that in 1985 there was not information sharing, so that the program makes a lot of an incident which occurred with the real defendant, the real perpetrator, in 1983, also in Manitowoc County, but one was with the police department, the other with the sheriff's department. And you have to keep in mind that at that time there were no computer records. Everything was in paper files, in respective agencies. And the notion of law enforcement working together then was something that was not necessarily common practice and, in fact, really not thought of. So you have that. And you also didn't have DNA at the time. So, you know, you then fast forward to 2003 when finally this comes out and DNA is tested, proving Avery's innocence. But, you have people in this movie kind of making a judgment on everyone in Manitowoc County based on 2003 standards for law enforcement practice and technology for a 1985 case. What goes on after that, I kind of lose touch with. I think there's one issue. I know my friend Dean Strang, who's one of the defense attorneys on the 2007 case, was concerned about blood that was found in the clerk's office. I'm not sure that there's really a full explanation of that. You know, my sense from what I've seen is I'm confident that the murder conviction, which is questioned, is one where a reasonable jury could find Avery guilty. Clearly, that's been upheld by appellate courts and the like. So, you know, my sense is the show follows a narrative which makes it gain attention, garner attention worldwide, but yet I'm not sure that that narrative isn't one that might be disputed if the appropriate situation were to arise. And I don't get into all the issues about DNA testing, but we'll see where the conversation goes.
Yeah. Well, Avery's defense attorney, Dean Strang, has expressed hope that new evidence could come to light now that the series is making the case and the problems he sees with it well known. He is hoping someone with information might be more likely to come forward to help spur a new trial. Rick Essenberg, do you have any thoughts on whether whether a new trial might be warranted for Stephen Avery?
Well, you know, I haven't seen the show, but this is punditry, so why should that get in the way of my having an opinion?
I'm in the same boat as Rick.
You know, two things. I mean, first of all, I mean, I've heard it's very, very well done, that it's not objective at all. And I know that people can put together very persuasive and entertaining documentaries making all sorts of crazy claims, like, Lee Harvey Oswald didn't shoot President Kennedy. How many of those have there been? It's quite clear that he did. So, I take it with a grain of salt. But one of the things that sort of a larger question, and I think this is a problem which I think a lot of people who I agree with politically have, is that taking away somebody's liberty is a big deal. And I think the public does not, as a general matter, adequately appreciate the importance of safeguards in the criminal justice process. And I don't know that any of those were violated here. Obviously, there were some problems with the first conviction, but I think that it just underscores the fact, and I know that this is, I think, also the case with many of these police shootings, that we ought not to rush to judgment. That these things are highly fact specific, and unless you've really taken the time to look at what happened, you don't know who's right and who's wrong. And so I won't say whether he's entitled to a new trial or not, because I have no idea.
Yeah. A lot of people are saying that this is putting our entire criminal justice system on trial, that there's, too much opportunity for police and prosecutors to frame an individual. Any thoughts, Peg, on that, putting the criminal justice system on trial?
I guess, one, it's trying to do that. I mean, there's no question about that. But I think that nobody is standing back to say, what are we doing procedurally? I mean, for example, photo IDs. It used to be that you'd put a bunch of people in a lineup and bring somebody in and say, which one is the perpetrator? Or you used to give them a bunch of pictures and say, which one is the perpetrator? Well, we have studies that showed that took place in the late 80s and 1990s, which show that there are better ways to do photo ID IDs. Now when police do photo IDs, they have a bunch of photos, including perhaps the possible perpetrator, and individuals are shown the photos one at a time, and they are shown the photos in a way that they don't know whether or not the perpetrator is in that batch of photos. So those sorts of differences in how you conduct a photo lineup have been shown through a number of studies that have been done to be far more accurate than if you are to just do the old-fashioned way, as it goes, with a lineup where you see all the people wandering from the jail or whatever. So there are changes like that which have been made since the original wrongful conviction of Avery. There are changes that have been made in terms of the technology and DNA, and some of that took a long time to catch up in, because once we had the technology, we had issues in terms of the volume of testing that needed to be done, backlogs for cases like Avery's and the like. So you had all of those kinds of issues. You had issues about information sharing, where somebody may have been picked up in one community, but nobody in the other community knew. And we've seen computers and the use of that. We've seen fingerprint testing become better because of technology. So to take cases that happened even 10, 11 years ago, much less cases that happened in the mid-1980s, and try to look at those practices and draw conclusions, I think is a little troubling. That being said, you know, there are issues that continue in law enforcement, and I think we'll get to race in a minute, but I think that the sensationalism that comes with the narrative in part fosters this kind of black and white, yes or no kind of situation, where it's either one or the other and doesn't get to logical discussions we should be having in terms of effectiveness of various police practices.
Well, we will get into the police shootings issue in a moment, unless, Rick, do you have anything to add about the documentary series putting the criminal justice system on trial?
No, I'll probably go watch it this afternoon.
It's a lot of people are watching it, that's for sure.
Can you fill me in on what it's like, Rick? I think I'm going to take a pass.
Yeah, I have to admit, I've been debating whether I wanted to or not. But here on Monday, a grand jury declined to charge a Cleveland police officer who fatally shot 12-year-old Tamir Rice last year. Rice was holding a pellet gun, and the officer said he feared for his life. In announcing the decision, the prosecutor in the case called the encounter a perfect storm of human error, mistakes, and miscommunications, and that the law gives the benefit of the doubt to officers who must make split-second decisions. After the decision, the New York Times came out with an editorial saying that Rice would be alive today if he were white. Rick Essenberg, what is your take on this case?
Well, you know a couple of things. First of all, it really troubles me when people take a position on these particular cases based upon their pre-existing political inclinations. We either want to be in favor of law enforcement, or we want to be, supporting a view of the state of racial relationships in the United States. And I think that that's always a mistake, because even if you think there's an epidemic of police violence against African-American suspects, or even if you think that there is no such thing, that doesn't tell you what has happened in any particular case. It could be that, cops are misbehaving all the time, but in this case they didn't. It could be that cops generally don't misbehave, but in this case they did. I think that the narrative that some people want to push about there being an epidemic of police misconduct directed against African-American suspects is simply not borne out by the facts. I think that any fair reading of the numbers demonstrates that that's not so. It's always possible to string together anecdotes and, claim that that this represents some type of a larger problem, but I don't think the numbers support that. And so, in my view, it's important to treat these cases as they come, based upon the particular facts of these cases. And then I think you have to keep in mind that there's a distinction between criminal and civil liability, that there can be a number of cases in which we would all agree that police officers have fallen short of the standard of conduct that we'd like to impose on them. They've been negligent. This may be a case where sounds to me like it's a case where at least civil liability should be imposed. But that doesn't mean that, and being concerned about that doesn't mean that criminal charges need to be brought. Having said that, I think sort of in keeping with what I said about the Avery case, I don't know that I know enough. And my guess is that most people out there listening don't know enough about this particular case to really have a sense of whether the grand jury got it right or got it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Peg.
Well, I agree with Rick in terms of the specific versus the general things. I disagree with him in terms of sort of the general state of things. I have done coroner's inquests, which were the vehicle by which a coroner could question the cause of death in the state of Wisconsin when there might have been some sort of criminal activity which led to that death. And they were oftentimes in the 80s used in Wisconsin in matters involving police shootings. And they were one-sided affairs. I was a prosecutor. I put on evidence, and I put on evidence usually with all of the witnesses involved and frankly did so in an attempt not just to search for the truth, but did so with an implicit bias in showing that the officer's action was fair. And, you know, I'm a wife of a former police officer who's retired. I'm a stepmother of a sheriff's deputy. And if you talk to either one of them, they will tell you that they are not at all biased, that they don't discriminate, that they are not racist. And I would say that those are fair explanations on their part. What gets me concerned, however, is that I am not a bigot or police, quote, misbehaving, I think was Rick's term, isn't what's at issue here. To me, what's at issue is the bigger picture. And in this way, it kind of parallels what we saw in the Avery case with photo IDs. The folks in Manitowoc County did photo IDs in 1985 that were standard practice at the time. But yet we have had research, scientific social research, that shows that those practices were not good. Likewise, now we have a growing body of academic study that is showing that that subconscious connections in people's mind between black faces and crimes are real, and it's real not just for white people, but for black people. I know there's a woman in Stanford, a professor there, Jennifer Eberhardt, I think her name is, and you know, and she's had studies, for instance, where you show people blurry images, which increasingly become more and more in focus, and people are asked to identify what the blurry image is. And if you show people pictures of black faces which are interspersed with photos of things like staplers or books, it takes them quite some time to discern that the decreasingly blurred image is a picture of an African-American face. But on the other hand, if you intersperse those blurred pictures with pictures of guns, they identify those faces as black faces far more quickly. So this sort of research, I think, shows that indeed there are some issues when it comes to stereotypes we have that cause people to react differently, and so when taken as a whole, we need to start figuring out how to address those issues. And that kind of research, I think, supersedes the anecdotal information we have. So you can say that the information is simply anecdotal, but yet if you start looking at research like that, you say, wait a minute, if I were a parent and my child was black, particularly male and black, perhaps young and male and black, the odds are worse. And for us to deny that a certain bigotry and racism doesn't exist implicitly in the face of studies like that, I think would be wrong. And to deny that it doesn't have an impact on the criminal justice system would be wrong.
We need to take a short pause. When we come back, we have a lot of other state issues to talk about, including the legislative agenda for 2016. Legislative leaders in year-end interviews were talking about what they want to accomplish in 2016. Robin Voss, the assembly speaker, said that the campus carry bill probably won't happen in the upcoming session of the state legislature. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about John Doe. And we will welcome the issues you want to talk about. We have an open line for you. If something happened in the news this week that you want our guests to discuss, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, the first Week in Review for 2016. Happy New Year. We are talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top stories of the in the news this week. Our guests are Peg Lautenschlager, a former Attorney General of Wisconsin, former Democratic state legislator, district attorney, former U.S. attorney, and Rick Essenberg, president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and a blogger at sharkandshepherd.blogspot.com. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a Week in Review issue to put on the table, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Wanted to get into the legislative agenda, and let's talk about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss saying in a year-end interview last week that, or this week, that he doesn't think that campus carry will happen, a bill that would allow concealed carry permit holders to bring guns into college and university buildings. Probably will not come up for a vote during this session of the state legislature. So yay or nay to that, Rick Essenberg?
Well, you know, I think maybe we're all old enough to remember there used to be this cartoon called There Ought to Be a Law. And as somebody with libertarian tendencies, my answer to that question is usually there shouldn't be. And I think that in this case, you know, Peg mentioned earlier these social science studies, and I think social science is sort of a Tower of Babel in a lot of these studies. There's a very interesting research project that's going on now that tries to replicate some of these studies in cognitive and social psychology, and finds out that in a tremendous percentage of cases, the results can't be replicated. You know, things that people have gone around telling themselves are true for years and years and years turn out not to be proven. I think when it comes to things like concealed carry, you know, the best evidence would suggest that, yeah, banning guns on campus is probably not going to result in any type of appreciable reduction in violence, and permitting concealed carry on campus probably isn't going to result in any appreciable incident of students being able to defend themselves. And so my inclination in a case like that is to let the people who are directly responsible for the administration of the campuses to make their own decision about what they think ought to be done. And so I'm not a huge fan of enacting a bill. I don't think it would be a terrible thing if it was enacted, but I also don't think that, you know, it would be a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Peg?
mean, I think there are arguments clearly pro and con on this. I mean, first of all, most campuses don't have magnetometers at doors to classrooms, and nor do I think they should. So whether or not somebody has a gun in the classroom obviously is something that you can't determine. And secondly, even if you have the magnetometers, if you have somebody with a gun who wants to shoot folks, as we saw years ago in the Kansas City federal courthouse shooting incident, you shoot the guy by the magnetometer first, and then you go in. So I think that our pretending that there's some way in which we can make ourselves safe is sometimes fallacious, and where we act only so that we can feel good or feel better about the situation in terms of our vulnerability. That being said, I think my biggest concern about concealed carry in schools, and I haven't taught as much in a college level as Rick has, but I have taught, is twofold. Number one is...
Yeah, I never wanted my students to be packing. I would have felt at risk.
I
wasn't always that popular, you know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, first of all is I don't think I want to be up standing in a classroom not knowing who's packing and who isn't, and the fact that if they are, they can, you know, tuck the gun in their belt or not. Not that I have that knowledge in the first place, but now I guess into my bigger concern is that implicit in a provision like this is an acknowledgement that it's okay to have a gun in school. There is a government recognition that, yes, you may have a gun in school. And to me, that just goes against my grain of kind of what the Greek philosophers and everybody like that thought of when it came to learning, particularly higher learning. And so you couple that with a third concern, which is that you've got kids who are probably some of them under stress because they are in school and worried about things, and also are young. And, you know, we have brain development studies that show that, you have a more difficult time thinking logically in terms of the development, because of the development of your brain. So a government green light to carrying concealed in school just, to me, doesn't seem to be an answer for anything.
Assembly Speaker Voss also said in his year-end interview that, contrary to his previous comments, he does not think a rebrand or an overhaul of WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, is necessary. He says officials at the agency and the local level both think that the trouble-plagued agency has an okay brand. Voss said he, however, is considering injecting more money into the agency to try to boost job creation. Assembly Minority Leader Peter Barca, who sits on the WEDIC board, called Voss's change of heart startling and said that changing the organizational structure of the agency was the only way to bring true effectiveness and accountability to WEDIC. Rick, thoughts on whether WEDIC needs to change or whether it's okay?
Well, you know, so people who think like I do are inclined to say that things like WEDIC shouldn't even exist, that, you know, the government exists to provide, you know, public goods and a social safety net, but it doesn't exist to try to establish that it's smarter than the market and can make better investment decisions than private people acting in the market and disciplined by the market can do that. And, you know, it surprises me when people act like they're shocked that these economic development agencies have behaved politically in making their investment decisions. When we set it up, we were making a decision that we would have investment decisions be made politically rather than according to the dictates of the market. So it doesn't surprise me at all that when the government tries to intervene in markets, we have special interests to dominate the process. That's why we have things like ethanol. And so, you know, my inclination would be not to rebrand WEDIC. It would not be to inject more money into it. It would be to get out of the business altogether, because I don't think it does much good. That's apparently not the speaker's position, and it probably may not be a politically feasible position, but it's kind of the way I view it.
Peg, how do you view it?
Well, I think if you go to Rick's point that government ought to exist for public good, and things that serve the broader base public good. Wiedek falls into that category. I think it can play a role. I disagree with Rick on that, but I think that those the role needs to be played in a way that isn't purely political as it is. I'm kind of offended by the term rebrand, to be quite blunt about it. I mean, to me, a rebrand is like when Coke decides it's coming out with new Coke and somehow we're all supposed to be happy about it. This is not a commercial product where we're supposed to do something around the edges to make the can shinier or the print more legible or funkier or whatever. I mean, this is an issue of fundamental dysfunction within an agency itself, and I think it needs to be overhauled. Its purpose needs to be considered. If it's simply going to be a political agency that rewards the support of those in business who need an assist, who have supported an existing administration, I think that's wrong. I mean, I'm still somebody who has an issue over Edelman Travel, frankly, and Governor Doyle, and the Seventh Circuit saying to the victor goes the spoils. I think in Wisconsin we always wanted to have a government that was better than that, and Wiedek is the latest in schemes which reward political donors in ways that don't necessarily, clearly in Wiedek's case, don't at all help the public good.
Here's another issue on the legislative agenda for 2016. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald says he wants the state Senate to move quickly this year on a bill that would rewrite Wisconsin's civil service laws. The civil service bill, which passed the Assembly in October, would speed up the process for hiring and firing state workers. It would replace the civil service exam with a more subjective resume-based system. Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald says that this bill would not end civil service. It would only change it. A quick react to that, Peg Lautenschlager.
Well, I'm very skeptical that, one, we need to make the hiring process faster. When I served in state government, we did not have a problem trying to fill vacancies, and we did so deliberatively and with haste. I think that moving the hiring process to DOA and taking it away from the various departments themselves is a dangerous, dangerous precedent. I think it opens the door for what are simply political appointments made by people who have political goals rather than people who are trained in an area and understand what is needed within a particular department or agency. I also think that we need to remember the lessons of history. Everybody can say, well, you know, it's not 1900 anymore, but we have seen and it doesn't matter your philosophy, your partisan affiliation or whatever, but we have seen that when given the power to create political power within government, that anybody of any philosophy or any political party will take that opportunity. I think we need to have some checks and balances there, and our civil service system historically has served us well and should continue to do so.
Rick Essenberg.
I mean, I think as much as possible, the hiring process in government should match the hiring process in the public sector. I wouldn't want to move centralized decision-making. I think hiring decisions probably should be made by the people who have responsibility for the work that's going to get done. I don't know that it's necessary to have exams or to have, you know, complicated processes with respect to firing people. I think that imposes unseen costs. Bill sounds like a mixed bag to me.
Yeah, we have less than a minute to go. I'm going to ask you both unfairly to predict 2016 in terms of the presidential race. Who's going to be running against who in the presidential race, Rick Essenberg?
I think at the end of the day, it's going to be Marco Rubio against Hillary Clinton.
What do you think, Peg Lautenschlager?
I actually would agree with Rick, except I think there's a possibility Cruz sneaks up if people can't figure out how to deal with Trump.
Well, we will see, and we'll talk to you again certainly before the presidential election of 2016. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peg,
Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you very much, and Happy New Year. Peg Lautenschlager, former Attorney General of Wisconsin, and Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Thanks very much to Bill Martins, to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come, and I hope that you join us Monday at this time. I'm actually going to be off on Monday. I'm on vacation. Dean Kallenbach will be filling in for me on Monday. And on Monday at this time, talking about twins. The number of twins being born in the U.S. is at an all-time high. We'll talk about what it means to be a twin and the latest research on twins Monday at this time.